Just heard When Will You Be Mine by Average White Man, releasing a live album in 2008. Before that, we had Up and Down by the Japanese group Tohoku Shinkansen. Oh, you know what they say, good time never lasts. It's time for me to go again. If you want to catch me next week, that will be 10 to 11 p.m. on Saturday. My name is DJ Lee, and once again, you're listening to WRCT 88.3 FM, Pittsburgh. For the last song of tonight, we're going to have Say Goodbye by Hiroshi Sato. I wish you a very good rest of the week. Good night.
And say goodbye, I'm gone. Spack Brothers Pizza joins you in supporting WRCT Pittsburgh. Spack Brothers offers the finest pizza, hoagies, and wings while specializing in vegan and vegetarian alternatives. Spack Bros is committed to offering quality food with an emphasis on locally grown, sustainable agriculture. Spack Brothers Pizza is located at 5107 Penn Avenue in the Garfield neighborhood of Pittsburgh. For more information, call 412-362-SPAC or visit their website at spackbrothers.com. That is S-P-A-K brothers.com. Rita's Italian Ice joins you in supporting WRCT. Rita's offers a variety of frozen treats, including its famous Italian Ice, made fresh daily with real fruit, available in over 80 flavors. You can visit Rita's at 3712 Fifth Avenue near the University of Pittsburgh campus. For more information, visit their website at www.ritasice.com.
WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. My name's DJ Tony Tunes and Anthony Cacciato, and you're listening to The Angry Young Man. Well, I did accidentally give you my secret identity there, but you know, it's all good. I mean, do a little bit of both. Do a little bit of the music, do a little bit of the talking. I'm sure if you listen to both, it's a little obvious. I sound exactly the same there. But just before we do get into the mix of things here, wanted to let you know that everything that's said on this program today is just the views of myself and my guests, and not necessarily those of WRCT or its members. So, without further ado, I'm going to run right into this episode of The Angry Young Man, where today I am very glad to have a friend of mine, the Map Boy, as he was very affectionately called a couple of years back, but also student Senate president, as of not too long ago, not the case anymore.
Only for six more hours, and then I'm free.
Six more hours!
Six okay. more hours.
Yeah. So, yeah, this is Kyle Hines, the lame duck Senate president. I'm sorry, that's a little
it's accurate. I'm a lame duck.
Yeah, no, but yeah, welcome to The Angry Young Man, another Billy Joel appreciator. Who, for those of you who are not Billy Joel fans, this is named after a Billy Joel song, The Angry Young Man, the song that we start off with every single Thursday. But yeah, welcome to the program, Kyle.
Thank you, DJ Tony Tunes. It is an absolute pleasure to be on.
It's Anthony Cacciato for the purposes of the show.
Is it Mr. Cacciato? We'll go with that one.
Mr. Cacciato. Very formal of you there. The thing we're going to talk about today, you know, we were talking a little bit about what we wanted to do, and we ended up settling on a wonderful, very relevant piece of current affairs: foreign aid. For those of you unaware, over the weekend on the 20th, the House of Representatives passed several bills. Three of them being. Aid packages to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan, respectively, amongst a myriad of other things they passed that day. But a lot of people very happy to see that Mike Johnson delivered on that, working with a coalition of Democrats and Republicans. But a lot of Republicans also not too thrilled to see more American taxpayer money sent abroad. Especially without oversight. So, I mean, this is kind of your bread and butter here, Kyle, from my understanding.
Not quite my bread and butter, but I got some thoughts on it, and I'm sure you do too. So it'll be a wonderful conversation.
I mean, we'll start you off here. I mean, it's as is the usual angry young man courtesy. What's your take? What do you think?
Well, look, I think that first of all, the aid package that went to Ukraine is it's absolutely fantastic. I think it's a long time coming. Speaker Johnson certainly stretched it out to the very last minute when he could have done this without harming Ukraine's defenses. But no, I think it's critical that we get that money to Ukraine. They're an ally of ours. They have signaled their intention to be a part of the West. They want to join NATO. They want to join the European Union. I think in the long run, we should absolutely encourage it. And Vladimir Putin on the 24th of February, 2022, gave us the biggest break in the rules-based international European order that we've seen since the Second World War. And I think it's important that we fund our allies so that they can protect against that.
So I guess the question that kind of comes out the gate, specifically with Ukraine, but also as a general thing, as it relates to just any foreign aid, why is it in the interest of American taxpayers to okay their funds being sent abroad, especially when we have very pressing domestic issues?
Well, I think the most important part that we need to remember here is that we're human beings first and Americans second. And absolutely, it's important that our taxpayer dollars go to American interests, but I think that we should also understand the humanitarian aspect of it. We don't want to allow 44 million Ukrainians to be overrun by a despot and a madman in Vladimir Putin, and we don't want them to be subject to a dictatorial regime. But I also think I'd push back a little bit on the idea that it isn't in American interest to have a free Ukraine, for instance, and I know we'll move on to the other countries shortly. Because Putin's Russia right now has, I believe, a population of around 130, 140 million people. Mm-hmm. If they were to be able to fully annex Ukraine, they've got two things. One, their population has just gone up. Their economy has just ballooned by about 30%. And number two, he can claim a victory against the West. And that's almost even more important, because if Putin knows that he's allowed to violate this rules-based international order with little to no repercussions and he's allowed to win, then we don't know what he, and more importantly, what his friends in China and Iran and in the rest of that part of the world will do.
Well, the thing, there's two things kind of within that that I would want to kind of poke at. Firstly, being, you know, looking at what, you know, from a humanitarian perspective,
sure.
You know, as someone who sees a fairly limited role in government, it to me, you know, it's the yes, we care about people. Of course, we care about people. We're kind. We're compassionate. And that's important to assist others where we can. But where the line is drawn between when it is a government action to do so, not in this case being for its own citizens, but for citizens of other countries abroad,
yeah.
You know, there is absolutely a place for us to assist our fellow humans that live on this planet with us. There's nothing that separates us intrinsically, but... That's where you say, is this a function of government, or is this a function of other entities that have a history of very effective aid and resource sharing when it comes to that sort of stuff, specifically to help the civilians that are most affected in this case? Because irrespective of the position you take in the conflict, both Russians and Ukrainians are facing large issues, humanitarian issues, and a lot of them are just not implicated directly as citizens. They're just kind of bystanding casualties, which is where, you know, like I absolutely agree that there's a definite need to help these people out. But from where that aid comes, I think, is where we have our split there. I mean, I'm a big believer in non-governmental organizations that operate based on voluntary charity, and that's a whole thing in of itself. But that's kind of where I would go with that. But as it relates to kind of confronting Russia and confronting, you know, the growth of Russian ability to project power, I mean, we've seen a more united Europe that has many calls for a united European army. The European Union itself has been assisting Ukraine. And that's more so where I start to think, you know, why are we still invested in Europe when it's very clear that Europe has the united capability to stand against adversaries such as Russia? Not to say that it's unimportant for us to have a kind of say or stake in the global arrangement of things, particularly because the global economy is something that I would place heavy emphasis on. But as it relates to European defense, we're not in post-World War II or the Cold War, where you have decimated Western European states that just made it through 40 years of war with only 10 years in between. You have fairly well-built, well-funded and well-equipped Western European armies that are very ready to engage with Russia, two of which being nuclear powers as well.
Yeah.
You know, I think if anywhere is more deserving of our aid and attention, if anywhere, it would be in the Indo-Pacific.
Well, I see what you mean. I just want to take a step back a little bit when you were talking about non-governmental organizations being the best donors of aid. I think in this case, there's an important distinction to be drawn between humanitarian aid and military aid. So I think that military aid, there's not a lot of non-governmental organizations that are going to be able to supply that, because, one, an ordinary company is not allowed to go to Lockheed Martin and buy F-35s or buy whatever the case might be.
Can they? But, no. Should they?
Well, that's a different question, I suppose. But no, I think the humanitarian situation is important over that. But I also think that it's important that we enable Ukraine to win the war. And I don't think the humanitarian situation is going to be fixed until the war ends, but we also, for the Ukrainians' sake, can't let the war end on Putin's terms. And so I think that the U.S. government, and obviously European governments, like you mentioned later, absolutely correctly, are the only entities that actually have it within their capability to arm the Ukrainian government. But when we're talking about European countries, I think yes, Europe absolutely needs to carry their share of the burden. But a lot of these European countries are. And if you look at the share of countries' GDPs that are going into this conflict, you see that a lot of countries in Europe, particularly Scandinavian countries, actually, are putting in more dollars per capita, more dollars per dollar of their economy than the United States is. And at least the way that I look at it, the whole of the democratic world should be operating as a team here. We have our allies in the European Union. We have our allies like Ukraine who aspire to join the European Union. We have our NATO allies, us in Canada and the rest in Europe, and really all sorts and manner of democracies around the world, South Korea, Japan, other allies in Africa and South America. And I don't think that it's right that those in Europe should have to shoulder more of the burden for this war just because it's closer to their home, just because if Putin goes for someone next, it's going to be them.
Well, I think that might be precisely why it's their given responsibility to kind of ensure that their own backyards are secure. I would say that I'm concerned with a model of the world order which still places the United States as the chief kind of backer of any sort of regional defense. I think that it's important that we instead maybe strengthen ties with our own neighbors and work on regional defense, particularly working with Canada on Arctic defense, especially when our primary adversaries are investing greatly in that. I mean, most obviously Russia, which probably has the largest land border with the Arctic.
Yeah.
Of any nation, but as well as China, who's been investing in the Arctic as well.
Sure.
You know, that's an area to look at. I think that we need to continue to work with countries that are trying to gain larger proximity to us in South America as well, in Latin America.
For sure.
You have Milei in Argentina that's looking to join NATO in some capacity. That I can see more of a rationale for continuing to grow and engage partnerships, but in areas where you have such a well-organized, funded, and equipped military force as Europe, the days in which we are engaging with Europe like that should at this point probably be over. I think that it's important that we maintain strong ties with Europe economically. I think that that is a crucial and key thing to keep in mind. However, to continue to provide for the European defense when they are at a point in their history where they can organize themselves and act in tandem in a way that is comparable to the United States by itself should mean that we can scale back. And where we can scale back, we should scale back. Because again, we have a lot of pressing things domestically.
Sure, we do. And as do they. But I think that while I agree that Europe should ultimately ramp up their own military capabilities, and I agree that countries in Europe that haven't hit that critical 2% of GDP NATO cap should be hitting it, the fact is they're not there right now. Like, at the moment, there's no European army that's ready to – or there's no Europe-wide army that's ready to go into Ukraine if this doesn't work. And the international order whereby the United States has provided security for our European allies – it's worked. I mean, it's worked for almost a century since the collapse of Nazi Germany in 1945. And it, given that it's working, there's no reason to upend it.
Well,
I also want to jump back a little bit at the point about the Arctic. I think we have enough manpower, we have enough money to do both. Our defense budget is something, and correct me if I'm off, it's about $850 billion at the moment.
It is a lot of money.
It is.
That's why I do want to, you know, define
working.
It's a
lot of money.
Yeah.
Well, it's certainly a lot of money. I would say that the vast, vast majority of that money isn't going into protecting our European allies. I mean, we just sent, what, $61 billion to Ukraine? And that's something like 8% of our military budget?
We spend ludicrous amounts of money on our military.
We spend ludicrous amounts of money on our military, but number I guess there's two ways that we can go about this. Number one, spending this much money on our military seems preposterous, and this is when I will admit that I'm among the most liberal Democrats you will find, but I differ a little bit from a lot of Democrats in that I think that we should have a large military budget, because it seems ludicrous until you don't have one, and then when you don't have one, suddenly you need more of one, right? The only reason that we don't have to use our military that much is because our military is absolutely massive. But going back to your point a little bit on the Arctic, we can still put money into that. We are still putting that money into our partnerships with our Canadian friends, partnerships with our other friends in the Arctic region, such as Denmark and those in Europe. But right now, the primary front in this war between the non-democratic Russian regime and the democratic West is not in the Arctic, and it's not in cyberspace. It's on the battlefields of southeastern Ukraine, and so that's where we have to take the fight to them.
Well, you know, I definitely, you know, I would push back and say, you know, like, are we currently spending enough money where we could invest in all of this? Yes.
Absolutely.
But the question is, should we do this? And yes. Can we in the long term? I would say no. This kind of goes back to my primary qualms and concerns with Keynesian deficit spending as a way in which we fund government activities. This will come back to bite us. This is something that I always talk with people about, you know, particularly as we reach $34 trillion in accumulated government debt.
Talk about a ludicrous amount.
Yeah, I mean, that's – and a large part of that is, and I'll admit, you know, very much driven by Republican presidents who have spent deficit spent heavily on the military, specifically Ronald Reagan. As well as during the Obama administration, we did see a large investment in the military as a driver of our debt. But there's only so long we can defer this. There's only so long that you can pass the buck until it hits you. And that's why it's a particular concern of mine that we try to be much more thrifty in how we apply our funds militarily. We have to be wise. We have to be prudent. We have to be aware we are working on borrowed time.
Certainly we are, but I think that Ukraine is just the wrong place to fight that battle. Is our debt too high? Yes. Are we running egregious deficits? Yes. But Ukraine is a tiny, tiny percentage of our overall deficit for this year. And now this is where I'm actually going to agree with you. I don't think that it's sustainable to spend this much money on the Ukrainian defense in the long term. And I wouldn't anticipate putting this much money into Ukraine in 2025, 2026, 2027. Right now, we're at a situation in eastern Ukraine where the front line is essentially frozen. I mean, it hasn't moved in any substantial way since, I think, September of 2022. And so there should absolutely be conversations in the back channels between the United States and Ukraine saying, hey, we're providing this aid for now, but you need to go to the negotiating table with the Russians at some point, and you need to find a diplomatic solution to this. Because, frankly, this war isn't in Russia's interest either. But the reason, I think, that right now Ukraine isn't able to do that is that Putin is playing the waiting game.
Yes.
Because Republicans have so loudly said, and former President Trump has so loudly said, that he thinks that spending money on Ukraine is a waste of money, that if Ukraine were to go to the table with Russia right now, they wouldn't get any kind of good settlement. And that's just because Russia knows that if they wait, there's a very good chance that in January 2025, the President of the United States is a man who wants to pull all funding from the Ukrainians. And if he does that, Russian troops can march right all the way through Ukraine up to the Polish border. And so I think that rhetoric has honestly been the most destructive rhetoric out of any American government personnel on this topic. I think that the best thing to do would be to go to Ukraine, say, look, the United States is fully on board. We want you to win this war, but you're not going to liberate Crimea. You're not going to liberate some of the eastern territories in the Donbass and Kherson and Zaporizhzhia. And so you need to go to the table and you need to figure out a solution. Maybe sign an armistice, do what you have to do. And ultimately get yourself out of this, because we're not going to provide you funding forever. But I think actually the fact that the Republicans are being so loud about not wanting to provide funding has put us in a situation where at least for the next 12 months, we're basically hemmed in. We have to.
Yeah, and it ends up being the case, you know, how much in terms of rhetoric does it seem that the United States pulling out would spell doom for Ukraine, so much as, you know, if the United States were to pull back financially, would it actually put them back that much, considering the assistance they're receiving from Europe? But I mean, you know, all that considered, there are other places that the United States did commit to on Saturday. And as we enter our last 10 minutes here, I do want to try to, you know, kind of poke and prod a little bit at what we have going on in that respect. You know, we can start off with the hot button one. We have aid to Israel. You know, this is kind of set on the backdrop of massive, and I mean massive, protesting by students at colleges across the country, most notably Columbia, where I'm from. But you also have I mean, back in our own backyard in Schenley Park, there was a large encampment that was speaking very loudly against American investment, be it on the government side or in our institutions that invest or do business with Israel. As someone who describes themselves as a very liberal Democrat.
On occasion. I've got my
moments. On occasion. What's your read on this?
I think some of the protests have been overboard, and there's no doubt about that. I mean, the protests that are saying that Jews should be eradicated from the Middle East, that a Palestinian state should take over all of the territory from the river to the sea, that it's irredentist thinking. It's not going to happen. The state of Israel is there. There are millions of Israelis for which Israel is the only home that they've ever known, and kicking out the Israelis would be just as bad as the Nakba was in 1948. But I hesitate when it comes to sending military aid to Israel. And I don't like saying that because Israel is, like we were talking about, one of these allies that has been with us for so long. And if you ask me at any other time, probably over the course of my lifetime, I would say absolutely we should send them military aid because they're surrounded by countries that don't want them to be there. It's countries that have in the past been prone to attack them, largely unprovoked. And they need to be able to defend themselves. But right now, what's going on in Gaza is, and I'd be curious to get your read on this too, it's horrific. I mean, I think the tally at this point is 35,000 Palestinians dead. A large number of them, absolutely to be true, are Hamas terrorists. But a lot aren't. I mean, the civil infrastructure in Gaza is completely destroyed. Israel has gone in, and they've taken out, I think, 60% of the buildings in northern Gaza. And they've kicked out Hamas, which good for them, but then they haven't occupied the territory because fundamentally it's not clear to me that they care what happened to it afterwards. And because of that, you have wide swaths of territory where there is no government, there are no civil servants, you don't have any sort of humanitarian aid getting through to those areas. It's anarchy and it's famine, and Israel is letting it happen. And at this point, I don't know how we can, in good conscience as Americans, continue to fund a military endeavor that's doing that.
Well, I think that we are both skeptical of aid to Israel and for different reasons.
For different
though.
Reasons, certainly for different
I mean,
reasons.
you are skeptical of aid to Israel because of Israeli military operations. I am skeptical because foreign aid to any country. We are not the same.
For sure. No.
I'm kidding.
No, that's a good way to sum it up. I think whenever you give military aid, you should absolutely think about what those guns and bombs are going to be used for. And in Ukraine, I think they're going to be used for trying to chip away at the Russian front line and maintaining their own defenses. And in Israel, that just at this point isn't what they're being used for.
Well, my thing is, when it comes to how are we perceiving the the actions of Israel, I separate out, you know, my perceived kind of like, where's my support in this war from, should we support them monetarily? So, you know,
sure.
I'll say flat out, should we be supporting them monetarily? No. Just as much as I'd say, should we be supporting Ukraine militarily? No. But in terms of, you know, and this kind of moves a little bit away from the aid discussion, more so to just kind of the conflict right now in Gaza.
I knew we'd get here eventually.
Eventually, you know, all roads lead to Israel-Palestine nowadays.
How long did it take us? 24 minutes to get here?
24 minutes, yeah.
That's not
bad. We did kind of set ourselves up for it. It would really be one quite the feat if we managed to start on something very domestic and then ended up there.
It would, but it probably would have happened anyway, to be honest.
Yeah, honestly.
But alas, here we are. There's
no avoiding. Whether it be kind of indirectly or through very intentional effort of certain people within the country, it pops up anyways. But, you know, kind of just to keep this brief, because I do want to also maybe touch a little bit on Taiwan.
Sure.
Because that's a little bit more future thinking. But when it comes to the position that Israel's in, you know, Hamas is very much a deeply rooted in the region issue. I mean, yeah. You're not talking about the West Bank. The West Bank is a very different story. Gaza is a place where the majority of the legislature there was elected. It was a majority Hamas leadership there.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's to in any area or system where you have something that's so deeply rooted, like, just think about trying to uproot a plant that's been rooted down somewhere for decades.
Yeah.
You're going to pull up a little dirt with it. And
just, this isn't a little dirt. This is, you're pulling up like all the dirt in the forest with it.
Yeah. And it's, listen, are they being slightly indiscriminate? Potentially.
That might be the understatement of the century.
You know, it's, I'm sympathetic to the difficulty of attempting to uproot something that is A, so deeply rooted within the area, and B, a group of people that will use very desperate measures that include putting innocent civilians at risk in order to keep themselves alive and relevant. And I do very much think that the more that they put civilians in front of them and the more apparent conflict there is between Palestinians and Israelis, the more Hamas thrives.
I absolutely agree with you there. I would just say two little things about that. One, I don't even know if this war is actually in Israel's long-term strategic interest, because for every Hamas terrorist that they kill, estimates right now are that they're killing 2 to 3 civilians, right? And those civilians have families, right? And those families probably don't have jobs anymore, and they don't have food. And
yeah,
throughout the course of history, we've seen that when you have a bunch of angry young men, to circle back to the title of the podcast or the show, with no employment and with no means to fend for themselves, and who are angry, I think justifiably in this case angry, they turn to the solution we'd rather they not turn to, which is they oftentimes turn into terrorists. And I think that even if it's not Hamas, we're going to see a resurgence of radical Islamic terrorism in Gaza after this operation is over, maybe 5-10 years down the line.
I don't know if you necessarily agree. We both happen to be in a class that spoke about the motivations of terrorists.
We do happen to be in that class.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, man, do terrorists all just want to be friends? I mean,
for context for listeners, Anthony does not think that terrorists all just want to be friends.
No. That was actually
it's a reference to a class.
Someone's gonna clip that, and that's the end of my career.
That's your career shot. Yeah.
Yeah. But I phrased it as a question. Do they? I didn't say I believe. But anyways, aside from that, I mean, it's definitely something worth noting. You know, they're playing a very tough game to kind of untangle themselves from. But in our last Absolutely. 3 minutes here, let's quickly shift gears to Taiwan.
Sure.
You know, potentially an emboldened China. Do we think that you know, we've been giving support to Taiwan for a while now?
Yeah.
But Are you of the opinion that China is gearing up in any way to assault Taiwan?
Well, I'm not going to pretend to be an expert in what the Chinese Communist Party says or does, and so I can't say one way or the other, because anyone who makes predictions out of that seems to end up being a fool a year later.
When are they not?
When are they not? It's certainly on the table. I wouldn't be surprised if in the next 5 years China feels emboldened, especially if the U.S. gives up on aid. I do also think one thing that would embolden China, and I don't want to circle all the way back, is if they see that we aren't willing to defend our other allies, and there's Russian troops in Kyiv by the end of 2025. I think that would certainly embolden China.
Yeah, I mean, it's
what do you think?
What do I think? Well, I do believe that, you know, at the end of the day, if there's any region that's most deserving of our material and political attention, it would be the Indo-Pacific. I mean, there's no question that China is the primary adversary currently. While Russia is kind of, you know, still in the game, a little past its prime as a global superpower, but, you know, they're definitely still an area to worry about. But we are pretty much out of time here. I did want to thank you very quickly for joining me today. I'd love to have you on again. This was a good time.
Yeah, thank you for having me on. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, well, thank you all for tuning in today. Again, my name is Anthony Cachado. I was speaking today with outgoing Student Senate President of Carnegie Mellon, Kyle Hines. This has been a great time. We will be seeing you all next Thursday. Take care and God bless.
What you're about to experience is a brand new vibe.
Right about now, NWA court is in full effect. Judge Gray residing. In the case of
something you've never experienced before.
Isaac Winchester never put something better, but the smile that she shows makes me a goat.
Something strong. And infectious.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the first ever episode of City Pop Central here on WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM. As you might have noticed, the name of this time slot have changed a little bit, but the quality of music will definitely stay the same. Here is Kaori Tokage by Tomita Lab.
Kaori no
That was Countryside Beauty by a Hawaiian band named Tender Leaf. And before that, we had another Hawaiian band named Summer. And the song was called Kona Day from the 1976 LP, Summer. Before that, we had Mother Goose with Boy Kifuni Sala Salete. And next, we're going to have something that's a little bit more recent. All the way back from the year 2010. Yep, 2010. State Cows with Lost in the Mind Game.
Expected him to be as the